My guest today, Kathy Kelly, is one of America's best-known peace activists, a passionate advocate of nonviolence, and author. She is one of the founding members of Voices in the Wilderness and is currently a co-coordinator of Chicago-based Voices for Creative Nonviolence. As part of a peace team, she has traveled to Iraq 26 times, notably remaining in combat zones during the early days of both U.S.-Iraq wars. Her recent travel is focused on Afghanistan and Gaza, along with domestic protests against U.S. drone policy. She's been arrested more than 60 times at home and abroad, and written of her experiences among targets of U.S. military bombardment and inmates of U.S. prisons. I had the pleasure of hearing her speak and meeting her in San Francisco many years ago. And that she is still on the front line of justice and peace is a tribute to the human spirit. Kathy Kelly not only talks the talk, she walks the walk. In the last week of July, she posted an article on antiwar.com and Counterpunch entitled, U.S. Supports Saudi UAE War Crimes in Yemen, which is what we'll be talking about today. It gives me a great pleasure to welcome Kathy Kelly to Takes on the World.
Well, thank you, Jeff. I'm very pleased to be with you for this stretch.
Well, you have done so much, and it's a great pleasure to have you talking about this very important issue. You know, I don't usually interview what are popularly described as activists, but you have proved over the years to be somebody really special. How have you managed to do this, and what has propelled you?
Well, you know, Voices has long recognized that where you stand determines what you see. And when you're in a war zone not aligned with any particular government or with the military, and you're living amongst ordinary civilians who don't have the blue passport, who can't get out, it seems that the choice to keep trying to amplify the voices of those who might never otherwise be heard makes a great deal of sense. And because we aren't answerable to editors or companies that might operate larger media services, we sense that we have a little bit more resilience, I suppose. Not that we have a loud voice, but we do try to remain as close as we can to people who bear the brunt of wars.
You have seen in Iraq from the beginning what we have done, and many times afterward, and since there was no investigation, no looking back, no accounting for those responsible, it seems the United States has just continued on its way. Now, although it doesn't have troops or planes actively fighting in Yemen, we are, as you write, are full participants, in a sense, in that war in Yemen. Tell us about that.
Well, right now, the United States is selling to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates the weapons that they've been using to bomb the poorest country on the Arab Peninsula relentlessly. And then the United States also, through its military, does air-to-air refueling of the Saudi jets and the UAE jets. So they go and do bombing runs over various parts of Yemen, return over Saudi airspace. A United States jet then goes up and refuels, and they go back and carry on further bombing. Also, the United States has been involved in surveillance and examining the screens and choosing targets. So in many ways, it's a U.S.-led coalition war, which is enormously lucrative for Boeing and General Dynamics and Raytheon and Lockheed Martin that sell all these weapons. And the Saudis pay up front. Meanwhile, the war is costing Saudi Arabia about $209 million per day. And so it seems that the impetus for Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners to continue this prolonged and enormously expensive war is because they see possibilities for a gold mine in terms of oil and other minerals and gas and being able to control very, very strategic ports, and the Bab al-Mandab being one of them, the opening, but also at the bottom of the Red Sea, but also the opening into the Indian Ocean. So the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, who orchestrated this war has said that a prolonged war is in their favor, but it's certainly not in the favor of Yemenis, 8.3 million of whom are on the brink of starvation. And just a couple of days ago, Peter Salama from the World Health Organization said that they are on the cusp of a third wave of cholera.
You would think that the United States, even health organizations, would say something, but other than some attempts by Congress to pass some legislation curtailing U.S. support for the Saudis and United Arab Emirates, there is hardly any discussion, even among the traditional anti-war elements in the Democratic Party. You hear nothing at all about Yemen. And you can comment on that.
Well, I think that people would care about conditions in Yemen suffered by people if they heard about it. But, I mean, a point came out from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting about a week ago. They calculated that MSNBC had, over the past year, presented one report about Yemen, whereas they did, I think, something like 459 reports on Stormy Daniels. So why can't Yemen count? Why can't people learn to care about people in Yemen? It's almost as though there's been a tacit agreement, be quiet about this war. So I'm glad to know that Congress people have tried to put forth a bill. For instance, there was Resolution 81 that was almost going to reach the Congress, which would require that there at least be a debate before the United States continued to support the Saudis and the Emiratis and others in the coalition by selling weapons. Since we're not at war with Yemen, why would we continue to support one of the rival parties? And Steny Hoyer, the whip, the congressional whip for the Democrats, said, no, we'll put forth a competing or a different, an alternative resolution, which was non-binding, so it was meaningless. Resolution 81 is still on the books, though, and people can encourage or at least find out what is the position of their elected representative on that bill. But I believe there needs to be much, much more done in this very, very dire time for people in Yemen. You know, the combination of bombing their infrastructure, and it's been vicious. The reason for one of the first cholera epidemics was because a sewage and sanitation facility was bombed. A crane was knocked out. It was very hard to get the place up and running. And the next thing they knew, the electrical facility that fueled it was destroyed. And so they had to use diesel fuel to try to keep it going. They ran out of diesel fuel, and they no longer could treat the water. Plus, people were flocking to Sana'a to avoid other bombings. And so that was the beginning of a cholera epidemic that infected 1 million people. And in terms of the starvation, I mean, you read reports about people going from one village to another, hoping they might encounter humanitarian aid. They have no money to buy food anymore because the unemployment is so high and resources are so expensive. And they find there's no aid. And one report said the elders are eating the trees.
You know, the way this fighting there has been portrayed from the very beginning, because by the American press, they love to refer to proxies. Everyone's an Iranian proxy. They keep calling, without evidence, Iran, the leading sponsor, state sponsor of terror, has become a mantra. But the Houthis, who are a Shia branch, actually in the very big early reports from that war there, when they overthrew a Saudi puppet president who lives now in Riyadh, even the papers at that time acknowledged the fact that these were not Shia connected with Iran and that Iran did not seem to have a role in the initial fighting. It was simply in a country that's been torn by war over the years. The Houthis, who are genuine Yemeni, overthrew a government that was not representing them and undemocratically elected. But you don't hear that anymore. It's just seen as they are foot soldiers for Iran. And whereas Iran has obviously given them some weapons, that's considered to be a crime on the part of Iran, as opposed to the U.S. selling the worst weapons of war to the Saudis. Perhaps you comment on that.
Well, thank you. You know, if we could just mention the weapons of war that the U.S. and the U.K. have sold, they're very, very sophisticated weapons, including four littoral combat ships that have enabled the state of siege that's been imposed on the port of Hodeidah, and the Saudis at times lift it, but then they can clamp down again as they have done in the past. And they've greatly slowed down the importation of desperately needed food and medicine because they insist that every ship must be thoroughly searched by a United Nations verification and inspection mission. But anyway, the United States has sold cluster bombs, laser-guided missiles. The UK has sold landmines. The equipping of the Saudis and the Emiratis has also meant that the U.S. and the U.K. send over specialists and special operations experts to guide people in how to use these very fierce and horrendous weapons. Now, it's interesting that so far there's been no like picture that shows a weapon that's been used against the civilians in Yemen that actually came from Iran. Antiquated missiles have been fired into Saudi Arabia by the Houthis, and that's undeniable. But so far, you know, we can document the massive billions of dollars worth of weapons sold by the U.S. and the U.K. to Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, but there isn't much documentation of weapons coming from Yemen. And, you know, at any rate, the United States has, you know, no right to be trying to decide who is going to gain control over that area. And it's also clear that the United States government, in as much as it were led by President Trump, who in his first international travel went over to literally dance with Saudi princes, and then the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, led a congressional delegation over to Saudi Arabia, again, to assure that we'll keep the spigot open, we'll keep these ties with you. I think the United States is saying to the Saudis, okay, if you're desperate for cash and you want to try to take over a land and a coastline that's not yours, we'll keep quiet about that. And meanwhile, the Saudis use mercenary soldiers from Sudan and from Chad and up the west coast along the Red Sea. They have been fighting terrible battles and displacing thousands and thousands of people all along that coastline, trying to take over that vital coast.
Well, one thing I recall is a press conference that President Trump gave with Saudi Prince bin Salman, in which he bragged about a big chart of all the weapons that the Saudis had bought from the United States, as if this was a great victory for the United States. It's astonishing, but what was worse was when bin Salman came to the United States on a trip, he was welcomed by the likes of Bill Clinton, Bill Gates, Oprah Winfrey. Everyone wanted to have their picture taken with him. Richard Branson, who of course is British, but nevertheless, he was like a conquering hero. And these pictures one day, I hope, will come back to haunt all these figures. These weren't Republicans, Trump Republicans. These were Democrats welcoming bin Salman. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary coup, but it shows the lack of political awareness, sophistication, whatever you want to call it, on the part of the American people, because all of our politicians who welcomed bin Salman, have gotten away with it. You write about the necessity of informing people and getting people aware of what's happening, but we're up against this kind of lack of information in the information age. How do we get around that?
Well, I really admired Amnesty International both this year and last year for going forward with reports of ghastly torture and detention of people enforced by the United Arab Emirates in Yemen. And they and AP together exposed a clandestine network of 18 prisons being operated by the United Arab Emirates or by sort of like paramilitary groups within Yemen that are responsible to the United Arab Emirates. And the torture has been so ghastly. It has included sort of trussing a human body, a person who is alive and, you know, undergoing interrogation, trussing them to a spit and rotating the body over an open fire. And there were allegations that voices of United States officials had been heard within these prisons and detention centers. So we then, that was in 2017, and then July 8th of 2018, another report was issued by the Saudis about increased detention. That's a July 12th report, but you can read about it. And there are hundreds of families who are begging whatever government forces they can go to. You know, you spoke of the government of Abu Mansur Hadi, who wasn't even elected. He was more or less designated as the only in a so-called election. And he's living in Riyadh, and his main prosecutor of his government has responded to these families saying, where are our loved ones? Where can we find them? Why can't their cases, if they've done something wrong, be brought to a court? And he says, well, we don't really have any control over the United Arab Emirates prisons that they're running. So, you know, this is an invasion by the Saudis, by the Emiratis. And, you know, it's remarkable that the various resistance groups, including the Houthis, as I suppose the largest group, that they've been able to survive this long. And yet it seems like now what the Saudi-led coalition wants to do, having bombarded the infrastructure, and that's including buses and roadways and mosques and schools and sanitation facilities, hospitals. Four Doctors Without Borders hospitals have been bombed in Yemen. And just on August 3rd, fishermen were bombed, and the entrance to the Al Thawra hospital was bombed in the port of Hodeidah. Now, the Saudi-led coalition is saying, no, we did not do that. It wasn't an airstrike. But doctors from the hospitals and numerous witnesses have said, yes, it was an airstrike. I guess that has to be left an open question. But certainly, the Saudis have regularly bombed the infrastructure. It now seems that what they want to do is take over the coastal area and possibly the main port, and through that, so isolate people in Yemen that they would more or less bring the Houthis to 100% submission. There is some good news in as much as Martin Griffiths says that on September 6th in Geneva, representatives of the warring parties will come and try to negotiate. But on the very day that the Houthis declared a ceasefire, that was the day that this terrible possible airstrike by the Saudis happened that has now reportedly killed 55 people and wounded 170.
My guest is Kathy Kelly. We're talking about the situation in Yemen, where the United States is supporting a war by United Arab Emirates and the Saudis against the indigenous Houthis and against essentially all the people of Yemen. You mentioned the infrastructure very early on. Even the Western press, when it was reporting on the war, noted that the infrastructure deliberately had been targeted, as if everything that was essential for Yemeni life to proceed as normal, apart from fighting, was actually targeted with destruction, as if to destroy the infrastructure, you would destroy the opposition. They expected this war to be a very short-lived war. The Saudis, of course, as you mentioned, have no army of Saudis. They're always used mercenaries from either other Arab countries or, as you mentioned, Sudan, Somalia. This is something that Americans, of course, aren't aware of because we do not see photographs of the fighting from Yemen. But you talked about, your article deals with the tortures of these people who have disappeared. It's not that they're taken as prisoners of war. They simply don't exist anymore, and their families, as you write, have no way of contacting them. And some, you even talk about some people from Yemen have fled to South Korean island. Perhaps tell us about that.
Well, that story moves me very deeply. They had managed 500 Yemenis to make it to Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, and South Korea's Jeju Island is actually a visa-free port. So they managed to get aboard a flight and arrived in Jeju Island. And so then what? You know, what are they to do? And it's very interesting to me that this isn't to say that there aren't some protests in South Korea and some who say we don't want to absorb refugees into our area. But the Catholic bishop, Bishop Peter Kang, issued a pastoral letter to all of the people that are Catholic in the island, saying it's a crime against morality if you reject people seeking refuge here. And he reminded them that 7 million Koreans had gone in diaspora seeking refuge during Japanese occupation. And, the Pope just sent 10,000 euros over to help with the embracing of the Yemeni refugees. And so in this little tiny village called Gwangjang that many U.S. activists have visited, because people there have just for years struggled against the erosion and destruction of their beautiful port and their UNESCO World Heritage Site grounds that have been destroyed in order to build berths so that ships that are the size of nuclear carrier U.S. Navy ships could dock there. Those people have vigiled every single day, and they've been arrested numerous times. But now they've also opened what they call the Hope School, so that, and these are young people, and they realize that people coming from Yemen, you know, maybe don't have friends, don't have many ways to explain what's happening, why they fled. And so they've managed to get translators to translate from Arabic to English to the Korean language, and people come together and learn from one another. Now, what a vast difference between that and what the United States is doing, building its walls and trying to round people up into detention centers. And, you know, it's also interesting to note that in 2016, the United States admitted 80,000 refugees. That same year, Yemen took in 117,000 refugees, and already 225,000 Somalis fleeing from the violence there had been living in Yemen. And we have to not only look at Yemen, but also the Horn of Africa, the countries like South Sudan, Ethiopia, Eritrea, parts of Kenya. Drought in that area has displaced hundreds of thousands of people. And there were some rains this year, which is better news, but there are possibly 20 million people who could die of starvation because of drought in that area of Africa. And so people go toward the Red Sea and think, well, maybe we can, you know, be smuggled aboard some kind of a ship that will take us to a better place. But the smugglers, the human traffickers, are very, very ruthless people, and they'll say, yes, yes, get on the boat, give us your money. And then when they get to Yemen, they put them in detention centers, the people that they're smuggling. And again, horrific practices have happened in those detention centers as people try to extort more money from people who are seeking refuge. So it's a desperate situation, but it's criminal for the United States to equip the most well-heeled warring party over there, the Saudi coalition, with weapons, with surveillance, and with support and cover-up.
Do you see any signs? You know, you write quite accurately, the American people have a responsibility for it, but we have taken no responsibility for the situation of the refugees from Iraq, from Syria, from Afghanistan, from the war, from the crisis created by the U.S. overturning of Saddam Hussein. And then overthrowing the government of Libya. There was a point where Colonel Gaddafi, before the Arab Spring, went to speak with Berlusconi in Italy, as reported in newspapers back then at the time, not the U.S. press, that Berlusconi was actually asked by, or told by Gaddafi, that if there was not a payment to Gaddafi of some $4 billion equivalent, that he would turn loose the African hordes on Europe. Now, Whether this story was true or not, Libya was the closest point to the European continent, and we see desperate people pushed by the wars that the United States has been involved in. Now we have troops in like 50 countries there being forced to leave from wars and desperation for the economies and the drying up of the desert. But America will take no responsibility for this. We look at this as if it's somebody else's fault without any even discussion, even among progressive groups, about the U.S. responsibility for creating this refugee crisis. Perhaps you commented that.
Well, I suppose in many ways people might feel as though there's nothing we can do, but that's so false. You know, every single year, the United States people turn over more and more and more of their hard-earned resources to the United States military. I mean, I think the budget this year is some walloping $716 billion. And, of course, that lines the pockets of these major military-industrial complex, war-making companies. I'll name some again: General Dynamics, which is selling weapons to the Saudis and the Emiratis, Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Boeing. You know, that kind of money could eradicate world poverty. It could solve problems with disease all around the world. It could assure that every single student in the United States graduates from a university debt-free, should the person choose to do so. Those are enormous resources that we keep committing to death and destruction and the creation of more desperation and more destitution. And to some extent, you know, the idea of fighting proxy wars under the Cold War hasn't quite gone away, because the United States is still in very strong competition with China and with Russia. And so it doesn't want to give up footholds in various places that still have resources. We could mention Afghanistan for one. I think Trump no doubt has his eye on the possibility that there are trillions of dollars worth of mineral wealth, rare earth minerals and other minerals under the Hindu Kush Mountains, and possibly, you know, extractable from Afghanistan. And Yemen is also an area which has tremendous potential extractable resource wealth. And so countries don't want to say, oh, well, we'll let China get in there. China has a huge military base that has now been constructed almost, you know, contiguous to the United States military base in this tiny little country of Djibouti at the tip of the Horn of Africa. And so, you know, people play out these proxy wars, and I think the United States continually tries to point to one bad guy, now it's Iran, and say, well, we have to prevent the Iranians from takeover. But when you look at the takeover that the United States has been involved in all around the world, it's no surprise that in a Gallup poll, the United States appeared as the most menacing country in the world in the eyes of people around the world. So this doesn't build its security for people in the United States. It heightens the possibility that there will be enmity and resentment and bitterness toward the United States. But it doesn't have to go that way. But as long as we continue fooling ourselves into thinking that the military of the United States will keep us secure, and even letting the military almost function, you know, militarism is the new religion in this country, with this false idea that that's what ensures our safety and that we must be obedient to anything the military asks from us, we won't be able to deal with climate change in this country or anywhere else in the world. And it's sure that there will be many, many, many more refugees because of the ravages of global warming and climate change. So we kind of have to wake up, you know, and be not be lulled like big children, constantly distracted by sports and entertainment and Stormy Daniels, and start to insist that U.S. leaders get a grip and deal with the very real terrors we face because of climate change and global warming, and stop exacerbating these problems by equipping the United States military to get involved in one dismal, sorry, failed, stupid war after another. In fact, I want to say that there's no war that's not a failure as soon as it begins.
Well said, Kathy Kelly. The sad part was the military-industrial complex was so smart and so intelligent that they have factories in virtually every state in the United States, and like including Vermont, which meant that Senator Bernie Sanders, as radical as he was pretending to be, and people thought he was, said not a word during the campaign about halting our military spending, and it still does not seem to be part of the new renaissance, whatever resistance movement on the part of the new Democrats, that this military budget, which is larger than the next seven countries, seems to be sacrosanct. And of course, we had the peace dividend after the end of the Cold War, and that just evaporated, of course. It's an extraordinary situation. And as you say, unless people pressure legislators, particularly liberal Democrats, who are more prone to be pressured, I suspect, than rockrib Republicans, although a number of Republicans who are in the isolationist area would prefer not to have the U.S. Continue its adventures overseas. But this is something that should play a role in the upcoming election, and yet it hasn't so far. Do you think it's an opportunity that it can play a role if people make it happen?
Well, of course, democracy is based on education, and we've had a paucity of education about the consequences of our nuclear terrorism, focusing nuclear weapons on and continually building up the nuclear arsenals around the world, and, of course, our obscene sale of weapons to countries all around the world, and our continual development, storage, and threatened use of these weapons. And it's just not something that makes it into news stories. But I think the opportunity for people in grassroots groups and within their communities does exist to take those steps that we can take, write letters to the editor, go to the universities and ask the chancellors of universities to what extent are they equipping their students who pay a lot of money to go there with the kinds of information they need in the world today. Go to the faith-based communities and press for resolutions when those faith-based communities get together so that statements will be made, and then make sure those statements filter down into the smaller communities. I think the possibility of campaigns like the boycott divestment campaign that has been launched on university campuses across the United States. It's hard for me to advocate sanctions because I saw such horrible results in killing hundreds and thousands of children in Iraq because of economic sanctions, and it's kind of difficult to cherry pick, but certainly the United States should not be obeisant to the AIPAC lobby, the American-Israeli Political Action Commission, or to the Israeli government, given the horrible use of conventional weaponry against people in Gaza and in the West Bank. We can think about divestment campaigns. We can think about ways to say we don't want to be responsible. I'm somebody who hasn't paid one dime of federal income tax to the United States government since 1980. I simply can't and I won't. And, you know, I'm not living a life of drear or punishment. I might live a little bit more simply than some people. And it hasn't impeded me from working and working hard in work that I believe in. So people can kind of reexamine, do they want to keep paying for war after war after war and for this obscene, bloated military budget? I mean, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King was right. The military functions like a demonic suction cup. And I know it's hard to actually refuse payment of taxes, but people can get together in their communities and ask, how can we regain control over where our money goes? And we do see this. Groups are working hard to say, we don't want another ICE detention facility in our area, or we don't want this transport of nuclear fuel to go through our area. There are so many issues that people kind of have to almost work on simultaneously. But I think we catch courage from one another, and that's what we especially need right now, an encouragement not to exacerbate how we can be accusatory from one between groups and between individuals, and you know, count up our own oppression points, but to recognize that the greatest oppression we're facing is the oppression of robbery that the military performs year in and year out, taking away our needed resources in order to build up massive arsenals and the capacity to attack and destroy anywhere in the world.
Again, very eloquently said. It's so interesting that there's never any question by members of Congress where the money is going to come from to pay for the weapons of war. But when it comes for public welfare benefits, health benefits, they say, well, where is the money going to come from? Where is the money going to come from? It's extraordinary, and the public puts up with it, and so do the editorial pages of our mainstream media, which more or less go along. I mean, we see today with the against Iran and with this whole Russiagate thing, the same kind of going along to get along by the media with the U.S. government central policies. And the New York Times apologized for pushing the war in Iraq, but it's been pushing confrontation with Iran as well, and certainly with Russia virtually every day. We have a serious problem. And I'm glad you're out there still doing it. Any last word for our listeners, Kathy, before you go, before I let you go?
Well, I suppose that old maxim, those who don't understand their history are doomed to repeat it, is realistic. You know, we've been so vulnerable to cartoonized views of the world with good guys and bad guys. And, you know, we don't have a perfect government, and a lot of other countries don't as well. But to demonize other countries or the leadership of other countries as an excuse for failing to cope with our very real problems that we do face in order to build up a military that would ostensibly make us safe from the demons that are often, you know, creations of our own media processes and military processes. It's simply got to be rethought. And I think it can be. You know, we live in a country that abolished slavery. Not to say that it's completely gone, the prison industrial complex is a reenactment of enslavement, but we live in a country where people don't smoke in public anymore, where unions had long, hard struggles, where women suffragists had long, hard struggles. So this is a land where people can
at that
say,
point,
up with
Kathy,
this, we will not put.
At that point, I want to thank you so much, Kathy Kelly, for being our guest today on Takes on the World, and keep on the great struggle you've been waging all your life.
Thank you, Jeff.
This has been Jeff Blankford, hoping you all stay safe. Thanks for listening.